Good morning. You are listening to Raven Radio. Today is Monday, January 28th, 2013. I'm Holly Keene, and this is Raven News. The economy in Sitka, like the rest of the state, appears to have turned a corner. According to the latest quarterly report, Economic Trends, published by the Sitka Economic Development Association, income and employment are on the way up. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
It's not a totally rosy picture by any means. There still remains a huge gap between housing affordability and incomes, for instance, and Sitka's per capita income lags behind the rest of the state. But on several key indicators, Sitka is doing better than it was 2 years ago. Gary White is the director of the Sitka Economic Development Association, which publishes economic trends. Most notably, there are more people working in Sitka, almost 150 more than in 2010.
When that was happening, you know, Sheldon Jackson was closed. We had nothing going on there. The Science Center wasn't happening. So, you know, a lot of this could be from some of the development efforts that have gone on in town with the former Sheldon Jackson campus, with increased seafood processing, with, you know, a couple of big projects coming online here.
When Sheldon Jackson College closed in 2007, an estimated 100 staff lost their jobs. The number of people working on the new campus has not made up that difference, but those that are working are making a difference in the local economy. In addition, 60 fewer people filed for unemployment benefits in the last quarter of 2012 than the 2 years before, and the local unemployment rate at 6.1% is almost 3 full points under the national average. White says that in working with government data, it's often easier to come up with numbers than with answers. Sales tax revenue in the third quarter of 2011 was $2.8 million, just about even with the same quarter in 2012. White thinks Sitkins might be economizing to offset increases in prices that otherwise might have pushed up tax revenues.
Food prices have gone up 44% in town since 2008. Fuel's about the same as it was last year. Cruise passengers are about the same as they were last year. There is some inflationary thing that would suggest that sales tax should be up, but it's fairly even to down just a little bit.
Sitka's population has ticked up over the last 2 years, along with enrollment in schools. Even though cruise tourism is down, Sitka's bed tax, paid by overnight guests, is up almost $3,000 compared to the last quarter of 2010. White has mixed feelings about housing prices in Sitka. The average list price of a home last quarter was $383,000, almost $100,000 more than the average listing 2 years ago. Rents are on the rise, too. White says CETA is moving ahead with trying to change Sitka code to allow for higher densities in residential neighborhoods, with the addition of detached garage apartments, also known as mother-in-law apartments. He thinks housing affordability is critical to retaining younger workers. Personal income in Sitka has not kept pace with the rest of the state and even lags behind some communities regionally. On average, Sitkins earn about $10,000 less than workers in Ketchikan. White says this is not a new trend.
Well, in 1990, Sitka's per capita income was $22,000. Ketchikan's was $28,000, so we were $6,000 behind them then.
White attributes this difference to more high-paying industrial jobs at the Ketchikan shipyard, but he's not discouraged. He says making up the difference means that there are opportunities in Sitka that have not yet been realized. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Sitka will soon have its own community endowment. The Greater Sitka Legacy Fund, a newly formed nonprofit in town, has been chosen as an affiliate of the Alaska Community Foundation to support philanthropy in the area. KCAW's Ann Bryce explains.
A permanent community endowment will give individuals a safe place to invest their money that will go back to supporting the local economy. Cynthia Gibson is a financial advisor in Sitka and was one of the key players in the effort. She says Sitkins already give a lot of money to local nonprofits and that the endowment isn't meant to take any of that away. Instead, it provides an opportunity for people to keep giving long after they're gone.
You know, accidents happen, boards turn over, people change and grow and retire and die and things happen. And so we wanted to ensure that the money given today was going to always be for this purpose. Always giving back in perpetuity, which means that, yes, you might give a dollar today, but a percentage of that dollar will continue to be put back into our community every year indefinitely.
Gibson says it will also allow for more planned giving. Instead of reaching into your pockets right now, you can decide which assets or real estate you'd like to donate.
And you can do that while you're living or just make it a part of your will or your beneficiary, we can be listed as a beneficiary on accounts or tax planning. You know, a lot of times people have assets that have appreciated or things that they don't want to have to deal with, and we can take those in, whether they're stocks or bonds or even real estate.
The Rasmussen Foundation is Alaska's largest and most well-known philanthropy organization. It's offered to give $50,000 as an initial investment to the fund. It also gave it to three other Alaska communities, Kodiak, Ketchikan, and Fairbanks. But before Rasmussen sends its money to Sitka, the local legacy fund must raise $25,000 within 1 year. It also has to set up a board that will take applications and disperse the money throughout the community. Nonprofits can apply for funding, and so can other individuals or groups working on projects that would impact the community in some positive way. Again, Cindy Gibson.
The reason we wanted to do this is for continued diversification of our income in the community and just stability. You know, a lot of people have a big heart for Sitka for a lot of different reasons. And what a great way to say thank you or you're important to me, to leave a piece of your legacy behind.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ann Bryce.
The Greater Sitka Legacy Fund will be holding an informational meeting for the public on March 4th at 5:30 p.m. at Harrigan Centennial Hall. If you would like to know more before then, we've listed contact information on our website, kcaw.org. The Tongass National Forest makes up a large part of Southeast Alaska, and it's one of the wildest places in North America. But some of its trees are dying. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
I'm walking through the Tongass on Wrangell Island. There are huge ravens flying overhead, there's a stream trickling over rocks to my left, and of course, there are lots of trees. Depending on where you are in Southeast, there's Sitka spruce, hemlock, and in certain areas, a type of tree called the yellow cedar. It's distantly related to the red cedar, but as tree pathologist and ecologist Paul Hennen explains, they had some family differences a long time ago.
I was just at a sixth grade class. We were discussing with the students how you tell a yellow from a red cedar. They're actually related. They're both in the cypress family, but that's an ancient plant family, and they're pretty close relatives of both of those trees that lived 150 million years ago during the Jurassic period with the dinosaurs. And so although these two trees look quite similar, they actually branched off from each other pretty long ago and are fairly unrelated.
Hennen put samples of both types of cedar down on the table between us. Each one has a strong and distinctive aroma, but the fragrance of the yellow cedar is overpowering.
Why would a tree invest so much energy into all these kind of aromatic, kind of sweet-smelling compounds, the chemistry that it has? They're defensive in that they slow down the growth of the fungi that would cause wood decay inside the live trees, and then also they kind of repel insects. So they're biologically really active, and they're really key defenses for some tree that needs to live, you know, for a millennium.
Unfortunately, that aroma isn't enough to defend the cedar against climate change. Higher temperatures and changing weather patterns are making it harder for the yellow cedar to survive in many parts of Southeast Alaska.
You know, we live in this wet world. The other thing we know, I think anybody that lives here, especially at sea level, knows, is that we live at this kind of transition between rain and snow. And so a mild change in temperature, whether it's throughout a week or two or, you know, from year to year or decade to decade, really tremendously changes the amount of snow we get because it's either falling as rain or snow.
There are two problems with this. Yellow cedar needs well-drained soil to grow the deepest roots it can. Although it's a large tree, it has fairly shallow roots. When snow piles up on the ground above the roots, it insulates them from the cold air. Without this protection in winter, the roots freeze and the tree dies. With rain instead of snow, the ground is soggy and the roots are especially shallow. Now, these trees have been around since the dinosaurs, so they've experienced many changes in temperature over the years. Like other living things, they move around so they can be comfortable in their environment, especially when it changes. But they can't fly and they can't walk, and this time they're finding it hard to keep up.
They have the trees adapt. They may die out in one part of the range and then maybe migrate and grow well in another part of the range. But one of the concerns these days is that that process plays out too quickly. The climate shifts. These shifting zones of climate are moving faster than a tree could migrate.
So why does it matter if these trees die? Well, they are one of the most valuable hardwoods in the timber industry. They are used in a lot of traditional and native construction, among other things, and they're an important component of their ecosystems, to the plants and animals around them. That's why scientists are thinking of ways to help these trees. First, they have to find habitats where yellow cedar could flourish, but where it's not growing now.
We think in these areas where it's kind of rare, say up in the Prince William Sound or over by Juneau, it looks to us as though there's a lot of suitable habitat. There's a lot of places where yellow cedar could grow, and it just simply hasn't gotten there yet. So we think this pattern of where it grows has to do with a long-term migration.
To understand this, we have to go way back in time and all across Alaska. In the Pleistocene, or the time period that lasted from about 2 million years ago to 12,000 years ago, most of the Alaskan panhandle was covered in ice. However, there were a few ice-free areas on the outer coast, around what is now Sitka, Prince of Wales, and Glacier Bay.
They were ice-free at that period. We think yellow cedar kind of hung out in the Pleistocene in those areas, and then it's still migrating towards the east from those areas. And it's just a very slow, deliberate process.
This is where the scientists come in.
The kind of gratifying thing now is, now that we have that sort of knowledge about what its vulnerability is, we're working with Forest Service people in the regional office and on the Tongass, say at the Wrangell Ranger District, to begin to form some way of adapting and trying to use that knowledge that we developed through research and kind of put it into action.
To help the populations already in the wet southeast, they're just nudging the trees uphill. They're planting new cedar at higher elevations, where the soil drains better and there's more snow. There are already some healthy patches of cedar near Cordova.